And I've heard it's quite common for somebody who's been sexually assaulted to feel ashamed or as if it was somehow their fault that this happened to them, which is categorically not true. And I think maybe those feelings come from social stigma or cultural aspects of their life. Obviously, you are the people who are the experts here. Can you, you know, bust some of the myths around the shame and the blame that people attach to these kind of, you know, hugely traumatic moments in their life? Hello friends, and thank you for joining me for the Way Forward podcast, brought to you by me, Fliss Goldsmith, and Co-Design Coaching, where we create your optimal life together. This week, I am hugely proud to be joined by Hannah, Emily, and Claire from the Derbyshire Sexual Assault Referral Centre. And today, they're going to be talking to us about the range of options open to you or someone you know that may have been sexually assaulted. We'll be exploring the incredible work that the staff at the centre do and how there really is hope and empowerment for anyone who experiences sexual abuse. So, Hannah, Emily, and Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So I do really want to start, as you can probably hear in my voice, with an impassioned thank you for being here today, because sexual assault is an enormously under-discussed subject and it sadly affects many people at some point in their lives. But here on The Way Forward, we don't shy away from these conversations because our aim is always to pull back the curtain and show that these don't have to be taboo subjects anymore. Now, I usually introduce my guests to our lovely listeners by telling them bits about themselves, but I feel that it's absolutely right on this particular occasion to give you the opportunity to invite us in to the amazing service you run. So if you could tell us a bit more about it, that would be fantastic.
Okay, so firstly, I think we all want to say thanks for having us and thanks for shining a light on such a taboo subject. And I think, firstly, I'd like to say how much our service is needed. According to Rape Crisis, and that's in England and Wales, one in four women have experienced sexual assault and one in 18 men have been raped or sexually assaulted as an adult. So we feel really passionate that the information is out there. So should you need us, you know where we are. The SARC is there for anyone who's experienced sexual abuse. But the majority of the time, we see people who've experienced sexual abuse within like a recent time frame.
Okay.
But we can help sort of signpost from a historic point of view as well. So if you've experienced sexual abuse at any time, you can contact us.
So yeah, so it's not just a service where clients would come in and have sort of forensic swabs taken. It's trauma informed, so we look at sort of any sort of issues that that person might have, and we can make ongoing referrals. So we could refer to the sexual health clinic. We can make referrals to SV2, which is another Derbyshire charity that supports victims of sexual violence, and they have therapists and ISVAs, which are independent sexual violence advisors. We can make referrals to domestic violence services. We can make referrals into other sort of therapy streams. It doesn't have to be just sort of sexual violence. We can make referrals to other services. Trying to think where else.
I think, you know, what's kind of taken me back is the statistics that you sort of gave at the beginning there, because, I mean, we hear about sexual abuse, I would say primarily through fictional things like, you know, film, TV, things like that. So we do know of it, but to actually hear those statistics and how it stands within our society is shocking. And also from what you were just saying about the different services that you offer, my immediate thought when I thought of, you know, sexual abuse would have been, as you said, Emily, to go to the idea of rape. But then to think of all the other types of sexual abuse that there are, I know we're going to come to that later, and the different therapies that people can access and would require, it's such a much bigger subject than that initial, you know, connection to the word sexual abuse, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think what we aim to provide is a one-stop location. So you can accept any or all of the onward referrals that we make, and we make many of them. Sometimes we can't even remember all of them because we try and adapt the service for the people that come in. And then we've also got the medical element, so we can provide emergency medicines if needed, and that includes emergency contraception. And then there's also an option for a forensic medical exam if it's recent enough. And that's where we take sort of relevant samples and recover evidence. We document what's happened and what injuries there might be, however small they are. And, you know, if those injuries do need medical intervention, then we can make sure that those referrals are made and that's safe. That safety netting is done for you to keep you medically well. And during that whole time, there's a dedicated crisis worker, which is what Hannah does, to support you. But I think ultimately what the SARC provides is a safe space. You know, it's super informal. If you come to us, you'll find us sat on the floor drinking cups of tea. You know, at that point, we're your friends. We're there to support you, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And just to add on to what Emily and Hannah have been saying, I think a lot of people think that we're just there to take swabs and samples for evidence for the police. But we do so much more than that. Mm. Like Hannah was saying, there's a lot of well-being, a lot of emotional support, a lot of referrals as well for that extra support for people. And there's two different routes. I don't know if you've said this already. Sorry if I'm backtracking. So people can either self-refer, so they can call us up and just come through on their own with a friend, family, or they can go through the police and report it. Mm-hmm. So there's two different options for people. It doesn't always have to go through the police. And if it's a self-referral, we store their evidence, any samples, anything like that we take, notes that we make for up to 2 years.
Yeah.
So that they've got that sort of 2 years if they did want to report it to the police long term, in the long term even, they've got that option as well if they're not quite ready yet.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what I'm taking from this is that a subject that is life changing and terrifying, the last thing you want is the support to be inaccessible due to a fear that, you know, it's going to be something that is either really, really violating on a physical level or re-traumatizing on an emotional level, or, you know, stigmatizing from the side of, you know, talking to the police. Not that there is, you know, a stigma to that, but people feel that, I think. So before we kind of dig down into the sort of smaller details of that, I alluded before that rape is not the only form of sexual assault or sexual abuse, and it can take many different forms. Would you be happy to talk about some of the different ways that could show up in somebody's life, or they may have seen it in somebody else?
Yeah, so sexual abuse, I guess when people think about it, they do think about rape, they think that it's got to be a violent attack, perhaps perpetrated by a stranger. But when you're thinking about the term sexual abuse, it's got to cover sort of lots and lots of things, which might even include sort of non-contact offences. So even sort of like your online grooming, someone being sent like indecent nude images, you know, children being sent pornography, somebody being flashed at. It could be that the abuse is happening within a family or within a relationship. So again, not always perpetrated by a stranger. And the stats show that around 90% of people know the perpetrator. So it's not very likely that you're gonna go and meet a stranger sort of in a dark alleyway. So it's about 90% of the time. And that's even higher for childhood sexual abuse.
That is a shocking, painful statistic, quite honestly, but I'm glad that you've raised that, because again, I think it lifts the lid on that sort of myth, perhaps, that if you are going to be sexually assaulted, it will be, as you say, on a dark, dark night by a stranger. You don't know that actually this is a more, sadly, day-to-day occurrence in people's lives. And that's exactly where you come in. So I'm going to create a kind of scenario. Let's just say, for the purpose of this scenario, that I myself had been raped or sexually assaulted in another way. What are my options? Like, right now, if this was happening to me, what would it be that I would do in terms of coming into your service? I know that you mentioned not too far back about the referral process. If you could just kind of walk me through that from, like, literally sitting in my home thinking, what on earth do I do?
Yeah, of course. So we always advise on the timelines is the first thing, like when does this incident happen, so that we can get what we're going to do when you come to clinic, because like Emily was saying about the time frames earlier, things like if it was a vaginal penetration with a penis, you've got 7 days to sort of get any evidence if you wanted those samples taken. So we're looking at the timeline. And we're just advising on that over the phone, maybe, if you've phoned up. Well, some people we've had knock on the door of our SARC and we've just sat with them and just gone through with it. But yeah, we're looking at the timelines, what's happened, type of assault that's happened, and what we can do for you in the services, whether it's taken swabs. If it's over the 7 days, you know, it might be that we do more support, well-being, referrals, that sort of thing. I'd advise again about the self-referral route or the police route as well, and then obviously preserving evidence as well if they did want to go down the police route or for us to store samples, preserving evidence, so things like any underwear, sanitary products, clothing from the incident that they might have that they haven't washed yet, so preserving all that for us to take. Trying to avoid washing, douching, showering after the incident, just to try and protect any evidence that's there as well. What else? My brain's gone now.
Anything else? It won't stop us seeing you if you have showered. Some people feel like the first thing they've done is they've run in and showered, and that, you know, that has then washed away every evidence. But like Claire says, even if you've showered, we do have that time frame. We just advise that the best thing to do is to preserve the evidence. I think because it's really hard to, for me, it's really hard to answer that question because it's so dependent on the individual circumstance. A lot of what we do is signposting and sort of onward referrals. And if we can, you know, we offer those face-to-face examinations. We do ask people to call up and book. Unfortunately, we can't provide a drop-in service because we only have sort of the capacity to see one case at a time at the moment. And that's true of most SARCs up and down the country.
Yeah.
But obviously, under certain circumstances, we have had people knock on the door and you know, we're all caring people. We do whatever we can to help, even if that's making an appointment for a bit later on in the day.
So SARC stands for Sexual Abuse, Sexual Assault Referral Centre. And so would your website be a good place to start for somebody?
So obviously today we all work in the SARC in Derbyshire, and I work across in Nottinghamshire as well.
Yeah.
But every area of the country should have a dedicated SARC. And depending on the provider, it depends on like the phone numbers that you call. But all of that information should be on the NHS website. It should be available to your GP. You can call up 111 and they should have the number. So if you don't want to go through the police, there is lots of places to get that. Even a Google search for local SARCs will come up with the number of you know, your local place. But if you called me up and you're in Manchester, I would call up, you know, Manchester will give you the phone number. So even if you go through to the wrong place, we're all sort of able to contact each other. So I think that's
there's going to be that support.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm just playing devil's advocate a bit here, but if I was, for this scenario, in an abusive relationship and was trying to look for your website, is that something that would be difficult for people because it might be on their laptop and their partner may find that? I mean, how do they get around that?
So yeah, domestic abuse is a really difficult one. And obviously, we first and foremost, we want to keep people safe. Okay. So I think a really good way around that is making an appointment with your GP, because you can go into your GP alone, obviously, and they should be able to give you the information. All websites, our website, and I think the support websites, they've got a quick exit button. So if you end up going on the website, there should be a large button in one of the corners that just says quick exit. And if you click it, it goes straight back to a browser page, normally Google, I think it switches to.
That's really interesting to know.
And just going back a little bit about sexual abuse, you talked about the stigma of reporting to the police, and sometimes people don't feel safe to report to the police. And that is why our self-referral pathway is so important, because it's an opportunity to safeguard safety net, signpost and support people. And also we can store that evidence. If within that 2 years' time they want to report, we've got that evidence for them and we can hand that over to the police with their consent.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really empowering, and empowerment is kind of what the Way Forward's all about. And you are giving people the power that has been taken away from them. You're giving them a little bit of that back by having this self-referral, because they don't have to sort of throw themselves on the mercy of somebody else. If they want to refer themselves, they do have this accessible way of doing it by going through SARC. So the next kind of area that I wanted to touch on is, for me, I'm quite a visual person, and I think that building up an idea of a space is quite important, especially if you've been through something traumatic and you are thinking, right, I've had this sexual assault and I'm going to go to SARC. I phoned them up. I have an appointment. All that's done. But now I'm sitting at home between now and my appointment, and I'm fretting about what it's going to look like inside, how many people are going to be there, what the rooms are like, you know, how, all of these little things that to me sitting here now seem inconsequential about, you know, what a room looks like. But when you've gone through something like that, the more you know, the less fear you have. And I think that maybe people would benefit from you kind of giving us a description of what it's like once you enter, you know, the space. So if you could take it away and tell us about it, I'd love that.
Yeah, I can add on, because I am that person that you've just described.
Excellent. I am so glad you're here.
Whenever I'm going somewhere or someone invites me somewhere, I hate not knowing what the place looks like. It triggers my anxiety really bad. So I have to know.
Parking, didn't we?
The parking, yeah. I was like, where am I parking? How busy is it? Yeah. It's really bad. It is a real thing. But our SARCs are made as a welcoming sort of place. So usually there's, well, in our clinic, I'm assuming they all have the same sort of setup. But we have like the initial sort of reception waiting room type of thing. Really small, cozy, you know, it's got carpets, it's got pictures on the walls, it's got a water fountain, it's got comfy chairs, sofas. And then we've got what we call the family room, which is just like a quiet, confidential room. It's got a couple of sofas in, it's got biscuits, leaflets, nice lighting that you can dim and things like that to make it really nice. And that's where we do a lot of our sort of history taking from the patient, and just gathering all the sort of information we need before we go to the examination. And then we go round to the examination room, which is a little bit like, if you think about a GP clinic room, it's a little bit like that, just with less stuff. So it's got like the plain floors, the plain walls. We've got the sink, the examination bed. What else? A little cupboard and a trolley and a light with a camera, because sometimes we take images. If there's any images, any injuries, we do have a camera which is attached to an iPod to take any pictures or videos that we need to of the patient, with consent, obviously. We don't do anything without consent. So it is quite relaxed, but the examination room has to be sort of more clinical.
Of course, yeah. That's giving me a really good picture, and I kind of did a little sort of smile inside when you said about the biscuits, because, like, you know, honestly, it makes the difference. I have been through so many different sort of hospital settings with my own personal illnesses, and anywhere that I see a little sort of like biscuit station, I'm like, oh, am I going to be all right here? They're going to look after me here.
Yeah, we're feeders as well. We love feeding people, honestly. And I think just to add to what Claire's saying, it's choice at every stage. So every stage you will be given choice, and you can accept any or all of it. You don't have to have, you could come in and go, you know, actually, I don't want that aspect, or I don't want that referral. And you know, we might talk that through with you to make sure that you understand what you're declining or accepting. But it's not going to be forced upon you. And it's so informal. Like I said, sometimes we sit on the floor, we'll have a cup of tea together. And I think, without sounding too inappropriate, there can be quite a lot of laughter. Mm. You know, the majority of people will come in looking like they've got the weight of the world on their shoulders, and they walk out looking lighter. Yeah. And I think that's really important to kind of point out.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing as well, I think, is that there's also facilities there for somebody to have sort of a wash or a shower if we want. We've got, so if they have had to give sort of underwear or clothes as police evidence, we've got like new spare clothes there. They can have a shower, we've got toiletries. So if they are sort of preserving that DNA evidence when they've come to us and had the samples taken, they can have a shower. We've got toothbrushes and toothpaste.
Wow, this is so far from what I would, if somebody had said to me, describe what you think the space would look like. Not that I thought it would look terrible, but this just sounds very, very welcoming and homely in a way. But actually, for these people, it's probably going to be a safer space maybe than their home environment, if that's where they are experiencing these kind of assaults. So that's really helped me build up a picture of what the space is like. My work is around emotional wellness, emotional empowerment, and something that I come across, not just in people who have experienced assault or abuse of any kind, but in nearly all of the clients that I work with, is shame and blame. And there's a lot of baggage that people have in many aspects of their lives where they feel they blame themselves or they feel ashamed of something. And actually, when we unpick it, it's not to do with them, it's to do with the other person or the situation they find themselves in. And I've heard it's quite common for somebody who's been sexually assaulted to feel ashamed, or as if it was somehow their fault that this happened to them, which is categorically not true. And I think maybe those feelings come from social stigma or cultural aspects of their life. Obviously, you are the people who are the experts here. Can you, you know, bust some of the myths around the shame and the blame that people attach to these kind of, you know, hugely traumatic moments in their life?
I think I would say that almost everybody that we see has some level of something that's happened is their fault. And I think the first thing maybe to explain to them is that when you're in that stressful situation, your body doesn't respond the way that you expect it to. So you might have a scenario in your mind of what you do. We don't know if you were going to get mugged, or you've got burglars coming in your house, and you think, I'm going to be able to fight them off or scare them away. And in reality, when you're in that stressful situation, your automatic system takes over. So if someone's in that state of trauma, it might be that they can't run away, they can't fight, they can't say no. So in their mind, they might have these worries about, well, did I actually consent or not? Because I haven't said no and I haven't tried to push somebody away. So I think it's really important to say that whatever you've done in that moment is what you've sort of done unconsciously, and it's to keep you the safest. So if that was to do nothing at all, if that was just to sort of, some people you know, might flop to the ground, they might be able to do nothing apart from just sort of be still, and that is whatever was needed in order to keep you safer. So I think a lot of people blame themselves because they think they should have been able to say no or stop or or push somebody off. So that's really important to explain.
It's very true, actually, because, you know, the trauma response is something that we do not have any conscious sort of, the front part of our brain goes offline in trauma, and it's the back part of our brain that comes in to protect us. And it's so true that we never do what we think we do in a situation, and that equally we should have no judgment over what we did in a situation, because our bodies were doing the best they could in the given situation, and that is that. There is no would have, should have, could have, anything. That is what it was. So talk to me more around the aspect of the shame then that comes into these kind of situations.
So I would think that that is sort of like a society and something that's come from like laws sort of hundreds of years ago, where people, maybe if they were sort of had lots of sexual partners, the view was, well, what would somebody expect, or if somebody was really drunk, or they'd gone and met a stranger, you know, off the internet, if they've met someone on a dating site, then that's where sort of all that blame and stigma, I think, comes from, sort of historically. And
I think it's really important to make it clear that 100% of the responsibility lies with that perpetrator. Okay, and lots of people feel shame, like you said, Hannah. Like, I think, and there are historical views, and I think thankfully we are starting to challenge those. Yeah. It shouldn't matter what you were wearing, what time of night you were walking home, whether you're in a relationship with that person. None of that matters. Nobody deserves sexual assault, rape, sexual abuse. And that's really clear to get out there. But I think, like you said, because of historical views, people do feel that shame. So a lot of what we do is kind of self-belief talk when people come in and reaffirm that this is not your fault. Mm-hmm. And that's echoed by the therapies that we refer you into as well. Okay. You know, I know that some of the therapists that you work in your other organisation, you work in as with another sexual assault charity, don't you? They echo that kind of like rhetoric that it's not your fault. And I think if your friend's been sexually assaulted, if you're supporting your friend, it's really important to keep on feeding that message that 100% lies with somebody else and it's not your fault.
Yeah, I think that is hugely important to kind of like underline that fact verbally, because the shame and the blame is some of the first places that we go, but actually it isn't your fault. It is not your fault. So, you know, thank you, Emily, for making that super, super clear.
I was going to say, the other thing I was just going to touch on is only because I've just, say in my other role, I've just done a piece of work about sex offenders, and I think another important point to get across to survivors is that they haven't just stepped out the door that morning and decided they're going to sexually assault somebody based on the way that somebody was dressed, how much they've had to drink. They've got lots and lots of barriers that they have to overcome before they get to that part. So their own morals, sort of society views, and there's a lot of planning, sort of how they're going to get the victim alone, how they're going to overcome sort of the victim's barriers. So that might take days, weeks, months, years before somebody goes about thinking about offending to actually committing the offence. So it's absolutely not anything to do with the way that you might have gone out dressed that day, or how much you've had to drink, or whether, you know, you've only just met this person. That would be something that they've been planning for a long time before that offence takes place.
That's really enlightening, actually, because I think we can all probably sit there and think, I would tell myself it's not my fault. But then you've got to kind of work with your own self-belief in that. And obviously there are therapists that can help you with that. But actually looking at it, sort of switching around to look at the other side of the mirror, is to say, well, actually, it's not just about believing yourself that it's not your fault. It's looking at the intersectionality of the person who's done this to you. And, you know, you can go right back to when they're sort of, you know, born into their social and economic circumstances, traumas that happen in their lives, which is not to give excuses for anything. It's to give like reasons that they've arrived at this point, which, as you say, are not at all in any way influenced or connected by you. So that's really, really helpful, Hannah. Thank you. So I think the next area that I want to go to is to just sort of, we touched on it a bit earlier, but to look at how the work that you do helps to re-empower people, helps to give them back the power when it's been taken away from them. And there may be people that feel they'll never get it back. So how does a SARC, how do you do that? How do you re-empower people?
I think, like we were just saying, trying to give that belief back into somebody is the first thing that we do. Listening to the person as well, making them heard, not just that we're listening, but we're actually hearing what they're saying. We're believing what they're saying. And that can be quite powerful, I think, for some people, because I think a lot of people worry that, oh, they're not going to believe me that this has happened and things. So just giving them that really does empower them at the off go. But also, we also make it known to them from the start, you know, you are in control of this whole process. We are here for you. So if you just want to chat to us, if you just want some referrals, if you don't want any samples, that's absolutely fine. Like, the choice is completely yours from start to finish. And we always say as well, when we're getting the consent, even though you consent to everything now, when we go into the examination room, if at any point you don't want anything, just say stop. And that's it. We'll leave. It's fine.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of helps as well. And in some cases as well, if someone's been through quite a lot of trauma, not just the recent history that we might be seeing, but previously, I know I've had a few like this in not just this role, but GP, when I was a GP nurse, there's people that have been really triggered by speculum examinations before. Right. So I've got them to do their own speculum and given them that power to do that, or they can do their own swabs. Obviously, we have to, especially in forensics, we have to watch them do it so that we know that it's been doing right and they're not contaminating the DNA and things like that. And they have to double glove when they do it. But it's just giving them that power if they wanted that to do that.
That's incredible, yeah. Claire. Honestly, I'm blown away by the amount of options and support, and the word that keeps coming back around in my head is choice. Mm-hmm. Giving people a choice at a time when they have had none, at a time when they had all their choice taken away from them when they were assaulted. The antidote to that, the antithesis, is to give them back that choice, to say you're in control here. You have the power to say what you want and what you don't want. You get to choose now if you are supported, how you are supported. And this is like, I feel like when we started talking, we sort of like, I was looking at like the iceberg, and this is the 9/10 under the surface of what people think a sexual referral, you know, sexual assault referral centre will look like, be like, feel like. And as you said, you're making them feel heard, not just listened to, because there is a big difference. Anyone can listen, but not everybody hears. And being heard is very, very empowering. So I think the other question that's really on my mind is about inclusion, because I've worked as a diversity, equity, inclusion and belonging consultant for the last 10 years, along with many other roles, like podcast host, who knew? But what I wanted to explore is, especially when we're thinking about sexual assault, are the services available and accessible and inclusive of all people? How does SARC fit into that picture?
Yeah, I can answer that one.
Go for it.
Big on inclusivity, especially within transgender, non-binary patients. That's sort of my passion. But our SARCs are really accessible anyway. So we've got lifts inside the SARCs. That's more for us because we're on the top floor. But patients coming in, there's no stairs. So if they needed wheelchair access, there's all that. We've got the high-low beds. So the clinic beds all go quite low down. Mm-hmm. If they need to get onto the beds, we can help them as well. We have interpreters for anyone that doesn't speak English. We've got interpreters.
you can bring a companion in. Lots of people have people who will interpret for them, or, you know, do sign language. And, you know, we can make those adaptations if you bring them in. We try to keep them out of the forensic rooms just to keep that DNA, that space clean from DNA. But I think in answering your question, we try and adapt the practice for who needs it, really.
Yeah. So talk to me more about sort of transgender people that might be fearful of accessing a sexual assault referral centre.
Yeah, so we do see transgender people as well. So when people come in, we always, you know, get the correct pronouns and we go by them. All the documentation refers to the correct gender. Mm-hmm. Again, when they're in the examination room, they've got the choice to do if they want to do their own speculum or their own swabs. Whichever sort of whether they have penis, vagina, they can do that themselves as well to take away that fear or anxiety of someone else doing that. Because we know that can be quite dysphoric for trans people. So just giving them that option can really, really help, I think, as well.
Absolutely. And I think that is hugely important because, you know, I always try and think of sort of the different lenses that we look through things through, and, you know, accessing sexual assault referral centre as somebody who is cisgender is hard enough, but when you add the lens of being trans as well and think how many different invisible barriers that puts up at those moments to where you will feel even more disempowered, even more shameful or embarrassed, even though, you know, that's not on you, but that you would feel like that if people weren't calling you by your correct pronouns, if people were, you know, misgendering you and not being respectful anatomically or things like that. And so I think that's a huge, huge thing for you to point out, because it will hopefully give any transgender people listening who have been sexually abused or assaulted to think, actually, I can get support and I am going to be supported just as well as someone who's cisgender. I'm going to be respected and I'm going to be cared for, and people are going to be kind to me for being me. And I'm going to be seen and heard. And I think that is so important that people know that this service is for them as well. So you were saying about the having the interpreters, having the accessibility from a physical side of things. Is there anything else that you want to add that people might not have thought about think that they might be put off by in the space, that you want to kind of say, no, it's not like that?
I think, you know, at Derbyshire, we're an all-female team. I think that sometimes that helps people mm-hmm. to come, because, I think that sometimes makes it a bit softer. We are an all-female team there. But if for some reason you would need a male examiner, we've got access through head office to be able to access that, so there's still the choice there. Basically you'll come through, if you call us, you'll come through to somebody really friendly who will speak to you about all your options and your choices. Like I said, it just all goes back to choice.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, is there anything else you think then that you might want to add in for the people who are listening? Any other services that you'd like to talk about before we sort of wrap things up for today?
So I just wanted to talk about SV2. So again, that's a Derbyshire charity and it stands for Supporting Victims of Sexual Violence. And they are an organisation where we would make referrals from the SARC onto them. And they will support sort of victims of sexual violence, regardless of, again, whether a report is made to the police, regardless of whether it was a sort of a recent case or a historic case. So even if the assault happened 20, 30 years ago, you can still go to SV2 for support. We support adults and children, males, females, trans clients. I think the only boundary is that you've got to live within Derbyshire, mm-hmm. and they say there's the therapists and there's ISVAs, which are independent sexual violence advisors, and they are there for sort of more practical and emotional support. So they might support somebody around their employment, around college, benefits, housing, other appointments, so GP appointments, sexual health appointments. They'll support somebody to go through the court case. So if they want somebody to liaise with the police on their behalf, they can get updates. They can support somebody to court. They can take them for a look round first and maybe arrange special measures, sort of like giving evidence via a video link or behind a screen or a curtain, so they wouldn't have to see the perpetrator. And that support from the ISVAs was there for as long as somebody needs it. So we know at the minute that court cases are taking maybe 2 or 3 years to sort of get to court. If somebody wants that support for that entire time, they can have it. It's very much tailored around what the victim or the survivor needs.
It's incredible to know that this support is out there, and it's 360 support, isn't it? It's not just looking at one aspect of the individual. It's not looking at this specific, you know, assault or abuse or violence. That's what brings them there, but it's actually the whole person and that whole 360 wellness perspective, which is so, so important. And between those two services, there is so much out there, and I think that that's what people need to know. They need to know that these services are out there, that support exists. So before we sort of finish, I would just like each of you, if you wouldn't mind, to kind of, if you could have one thing to say to somebody who's listening, who, I don't know, potentially they have been assaulted, or they may think they know that something's happening to somebody else, or that it's just made their ears prick up and think, oh, that this could be something I need to access. What would you say to them before signing off? What's the one thing you want to impart on them before they go? So we'll go around and we'll start first with you, Claire, if that's okay.
Yeah. I think just contact us. Yeah. Even if you don't want to report it to the police, sometimes it's nice just to get it off, get it out your system and tell somebody what's happened, and then just go from there. And like I said earlier, like, they don't need to go through with the examination, the samples. If they just want that support, the mental health support, that's what we're here for. And yeah, and just like we were saying earlier about the guilt, like, they're not to blame. It's only one person to blame. That's the person that's committed the crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I will put the contact details in the show notes, but if you want to say them as a sign off as well, that's fine. But they will be in the show notes, I can assure you of that.
I think because you broadcast it, you're not just broadcasting Derbyshire, are you? So I would say, obviously, put our details in the show notes, but I would say go to the NHS website. That's where you're going to find your most local service if you need us. But if I could say, you know, to anybody who's been sexually assaulted or like you said, if there is pricked up, just remind yourself, this is not your fault. This is not your fault, okay? And you have options. And if you would like help, call us, contact us. You've got options and we can talk those through. And even if you do call us and you don't want to say your name, we can give you that advice anonymously as well. So you don't have to tell us who you are or where you are. We can still give that advice over the phone.
Yeah, it is not your fault and the power lies with you. Yeah. You have those choices. Thank you.
I think just the same as Claire and Emily said, that if somebody, like I say, is listening to it and thinks, well, actually, you know, something's happened to me, or I want to give information to a friend, they're saying that, you know, you're not going to be turned away, you're not going to be sort of not believed, you're going to be believed, you're going to be listened to, and just, yeah, that it's not your fault what's happened.
Honestly, I can't, go on.
Can I also add something just before
we
finish?
Of course you can.
I think the other aspect of this is that if you are a nurse or somebody who works in care, I really want to point out how rewarding it is, a rewarding area it is to work in. So if you've listened to it and you think, and your ears are pricked up and you think, oh, actually, that might be something that I want to do, you can also get in touch with us. And we can, you know, talk about that from a careers point of view, because, you know, I didn't know anything about it before I went into it. And luckily, I loved it. And I think it's really rewarding. I don't know whether you guys agree. So from that point of view as well, just if you're listening and you think, oh, maybe I want to find out more about how I can help people, then please get in touch.
Yeah, we definitely need more of these incredible people in the world. And I can't thank you three ladies for coming in, giving me your time, going into such breadth and depth about the support that is out there, and really empowering people who are listening, because that is, it's literally my mission in life, is to give the power back to the people who have been disenfranchised, who have been, you know, disempowered. And just this conversation here, it's not just a conversation here, it is going to impact more and more lives, just like the work that you do every day, you know, impacts lives for the better. So I'd just like to thank you for coming on and being here. And I know that our listeners will have taken a huge amount away from this. So that is it for this week. And of course, remember, if you would like to work in a fully supported way on your emotional wellness in any way, please do head over to my website, which is codesignwithfliss.com, and we can talk more about the empowerment that you definitely deserve. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. Now we know more about sexual assault and the support that you so, so richly deserve. And now we know the way forward.